This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
For those of you who may have been watching this week, the May unemployment numbers were released on Friday, and they are far below what was expected. This could be another sign, Jim. We've talked about this for the last several weeks on the program, that the markets are indeed weakening. But what's funny is, it's election year, so why is it funny? Washington's still bragging about the economic recovery, although in all honesty, it's the most unusual recovery since World War II. And it seems to go not only in fits and starts, but there seems to be a cyclical pattern with slowdowns in both the fourth quarter and the first quarter. And then it seems to pick up again and everybody says, oh, hurrah. And then sure enough, it slows down on the fourth quarter. Most unusual recovery since World War II, I would say.
Yeah, I guess the thing that makes it very unusual, John, is it hasn't been consistent. Usually when you come out of a recession, the Fed lowers interest rates. This time they lowered it down to zero, and you get a very, very strong recovery, and the economy starts growing at 4%, 5%, 6%, and it accelerates out of that recovery. And we got that for sort of 1 year. We got that in 2009 when the government, Obama's stimulus package was $1 trillion. The Fed launched QE1. That was another trillion. So you had $2 trillion injected into the economy, and the best growth rates that we got in this economic recovery were probably in 2009, because the recession ended in the summer, and the two quarters, the third and fourth quarter leading into the first part of 2010, were very strong. But after that, John, it was kind of like almost a drug high. You know, we had this injection of stimulus, the economy picks up, then it kind of wears off. And what happened, as we've seen, we've had different economic stimulus programs. We had QE1, 2, 3, and 4. And so this economy is running on pure stimulus. And if it doesn't have the stimulus, it begins to slow down. And we're going to talk about what has happened here with this economy beginning in November of 2014, when the Fed finally ended its tapering program, where it was injecting $80 billion a month into the financial markets, and that was working its way into the economy. So the other thing that also that makes this economic recovery unusual is probably been the most anemic economic recovery in probably since World War II, because we have yet to hit a 3% growth rate in any 1 year. In fact, we've been growing more at 2% and less than the 3 or 4%.
Yeah, there seems to be a projection, Jim, too. You know, I said how things slow down in the fourth quarter, first quarter. They'd be projecting economic growth, but of course, as things would disappoint them, they'd keep projecting that, and then all of a sudden they'd have to revise the projections. I guess the Fed is the most notorious in this.
Well, yeah. I mean, they revised. Everybody remembers what they said in December. They changed that in January and March, and they'll probably change it as they get towards the end of the year, because we'll get into it in just a moment. There's no way we're going to hit the economic growth rates the Fed is targeting for this year, even though they've lowered them. But, John, this has been an unusual recovery. It's been unusual because we've had these fit and starts, as you talked about, slowing down in the fourth quarter and the first quarter of the year, picking up in the second and third quarter. And then the other thing that made it unusual was the economic growth rates. But we've had so much to counteract monetary stimulus. On one hand, we have the Fed injecting money into the economy. On the other hand, you have taxes and regulations. And so that has stymied the economy. Banks have been hit with regulations, so they've been tighter on lending, so we haven't seen the growth in credit. But we're in the latter stages of this economic recovery, and it's our prediction that we're heading into a recession. But right now, John, the good news for the average consumer, if you're listening to this program, is we've seen a shift in the economy from Wall Street to Main Street.
Okay, explain that to people, because I was in a conversation with a progressive gentleman yesterday about all of this, and there seems to be either a focus on Wall Street or Main Street or Congress, and people can't put the whole picture together.
Well, if you take a look at what the Fed did when it launched QE1 in March of 2009, they were injecting money into the financial markets, in the financial markets responded in kind, because that's how the Fed was impacting the economy. And plus the fact that the S&P 500 had fallen from around 1500 down to 666 on March 9. So the first injection mainly went to Wall Street, and with quantitative easing, the greatest impact was on financial assets. And as financial assets started to go up, we had double-digit returns in the market in 2009. We had double-digit returns in the market in 2010. 2011 was a flat year, and everybody remembers all the crises that happened in 2011. But then 2012 and 2013, we had a 17% return on Wall Street, a 30% return in 2013, and a 10% return in 2014. We've been flat since 2014. So that's why you're hearing a lot of, like the Bernie Sanders railing against Wall Street. Well, guess what, folks? Everybody has a 401k, a 403b, or a 457. So everybody that has had any kind of money in a pension plan has benefited. But the main benefits of this recovery have been in financial assets and now real estate appreciation versus the economy, because the economy has not been growing at 3%. Now, what I say, it's now Main Street's turn. If you take a look at the stock market really peaked in November of 2014. What happened? That was the last month the Fed ended its stimulus program. Since November 1st of 2014 to this Friday, the S&P 500 only grew by 3.84%. So in a year and a half, the S&P is up less than 4%. It's 7.5% if you count dividends. Now, when I say Main Street, the good news is the unemployment rate is fallen from 10.3% to this Friday, 4.7%. We'll get to why that 4.7% number is not a real good number. But the fact is, the unemployment rate has come down. And one thing that the Fed is concerned about and it doesn't like, wages are starting to rise now. First, you had the dollar hurt corporate profits. Now wages are starting to rise. And that's something the Fed doesn't like. It considers it inflation. But on Main Street, rising wages is a good thing. The other thing that's happening is low interest rates. So if you are a borrower, whether you have a home equity loan, you're a first-time buyer, or you've refinanced your mortgage, you're saving lots of money and you're benefiting from the lowest interest rates in history. And then on top of that, contrary to what Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are talking about, rising stock prices has benefited just about most Americans, because if you work for the government, you may have a 457 plan. If you're a school teacher, you might have a 403b plan. And if you work in the private sector, you may have a 401k. So the S&P has gone from just under 700 to today at 2000 or 2100. So everybody has benefited from rising stock prices, and most especially now, and it has a bigger impact on people's, let's say, economic well-being, is rising housing prices. So the shift now this year has been moving more towards Main Street in the form of rising wages, lower interest rates, rising housing prices, which is good news for the consumer, and the consumer has been the main beneficiary now versus, let's say, double-digit returns in the stock market as we saw coming out of the 2009 bottom.
Well, since we started talking about the weakening labor market, if you look at auto sales, they're strong. People can buy a house. Things are in reasonable category. But what kind of a trend is this, and how long can we expect it to go?
Well, there's three things that are going on right now that are holding up the economy. It's mainly the service economy that's been the strongest that's holding up right now. And housing and auto are having an impact on this economy along with consumer spending. We just got the existing home sales for April. They were up 5.1%. That sales index is up to 116.3. John, that's the highest that we've seen this index since February of 2006. Home builders and realtors are talking about tightening supply, low inventory. The inventory of new homes is fallen to 4.7 months. And there's some good news on that in the sense that, you know, this low inventory is driving up housing prices, which is benefiting most homeowners. The bad news, it's making it more expensive for first-time homebuyers to get in this market. In fact, the Case-Shiller Price Index, it's within 4% of the peak reached in housing in 2006. So it's one of the reasons why we've seen an increase in, let's say, consumer confidence. A lot of that is a reflection of what's happening to housing prices and also what's happening to the stock market. If you go back to consumer sentiment in January and February, it was almost at record lows because what was happening? The stock market was down. So consumer sentiment is a very fickle indicator, and that can go up and down depending on what's going on, mainly in the stock market. Because when you turn on the television, you're seeing the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 250 points every single day like we were in January and February. Of course, that weighs on people's confidence. But overall, new home sales are the strongest gain that they've seen in 8 years. It's up, the latest reading, it's up 17% over the previous month. And new home sales year over year are up 5.4%. And we're seeing sort of like two areas of the housing market. On the low end, anything that's out there on the low end sells immediately, John. I've been reading stories in the Wall Street Journal and our local online paper here that, you know, we're seeing homes, low-end homes disappear in a week. You put them on the market, they're gone. I had a client that put their house on the market. They sold it within 2 days. So, you know, you're seeing this flourishing market on the high end and also on the low end. The problem is building remains muted. There's still a shortage of workers, supplies. And the low end, it is just getting tougher and tougher because lenders are required as a result of regulation. There's tougher lending standards. We know from the survey, the Fed survey on bank lending officers, that they're basically tightening credit, especially in the commercial industrial side loans. And then also, we're seeing a lot of tech layoffs. You know, one thing about technology, it's very disruptive. So you have leaders like your Google, Alphabet, and Apple, and you know, companies like that. But the old line tech companies are laying off a lot of workers, and a lot of technology is changing the way we manufacture things with automation. So on the housing and auto side, John, there's been some really good news, which is holding up on Wall Street. And once again, three things or four things that are going for consumers right now: a low unemployment rate, two, rising wages, three, low interest rates, four, rising stock and home prices. Now I'd add number five, low gasoline prices, even though oil has gone up from $26 a barrel to $50 on the, close to this Friday. You're still not paying the same kind of prices at the pump that you were back in 2014 when the price of oil was over $100 a barrel. So those four things are flowing through to Main Street. So Main Street, which is typically recovers towards the final stages of an economic recovery, and we'll get into where we are in the business cycle here in a moment and why I think we're heading towards a recession. But we're seeing that. So the main benefits this year have been more on Main Street than on Wall Street.
You know, it's amazing, too, but you would expect it during an election year. We've been talking about how unusual an economy this is with below growth rates. But if you look at what's being discussed on the campaign trail, whether we look at Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, they're both talking about jobs, both talking about the middle guy. Senator Sanders is talking about trying to create jobs by spending. They're different methodologies, but that's their focus right now.
Well, it is. And because in this economic recovery, as we've talked about, economic growth has been subpar. Wages have been stagnant. Only recently have they begun to rise. And even though all of these things that I'm talking about right now that are benefiting the consumer on Main Street, we're still below normal in terms of economic recovery. And that's why there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about the scars of two bear markets and especially the financial recession. Talking about people that lost their jobs that may have been reemployed, but they're not making the same wages. We did a story a couple of weeks ago on the show. It was based on an extensive article on this economic recovery from the Wall Street Journal. And they were talking about this guy that was a tech manager up in Silicon Valley. He was making six figures a year. He got laid off during the tech bust, got rehired in the public sector, got laid off in 2008. And has basically been doing subcontracting and has actually gone back to school. But staying with what is positive right now on Main Street and why we're coming to the end of this economic recovery, consumer spending, as a result of the things I mentioned, whether it's rising wages, low interest rates, low gasoline prices, all those things, personal spending was up 1% in April. U.S. consumer sentiment is one of the highest levels in 11 months, according to the University of Michigan survey. And all of this, they're citing is, you know, people feel good. When you go to the gas station, I don't know what it's like where you're at, John. They probably sell a lot of trucks. But out here, you know, it's hard to get parking space in parking lots now because you're seeing so many gas-guzzling SUVs again because gasoline has been cheap. Cheap gasoline, low interest rates. And once again, I don't care what anybody says about Wall Street. Everybody loves rising stock prices because most people have some form of mutual fund ownership, stock ownership, and a pension plan. So all of those things are positive. And those are the things that are resonating on Main Street. But as you mentioned, John, wages have been stagnant. A lot of people are underemployed. In fact, the true unemployment rate today is somewhere around 10%. When you consider the number of part-time workers that have resulted the passage of Obamacare. Because if you're a business and you have workers that don't work work less than 30 hours, you don't have to cover all the expensive medical insurance that is required with Obamacare. And it's one of the reasons why you're seeing the rise of part-time and temp employment, as we call it in the gig economy.
Well, okay, if we assume that things are good on Main Street, at least for now, we still have to ask about the manufacturing sector because, you know, Trump is thumping on this one too. Trade deficits are rising. We have other issues related to that. So it's not all well everywhere.
No, and it, probably the hardest impact since 2014 and the change in Fed policy has been the U.S. manufacturing sector. And, you know, contrary to what Trump is saying, a rising dollar makes U.S. goods more expensive, and that's hurting. They just reported the trade deficit widened in March by 5.3%. Exports were up only 1.5%. Imports are up 2.1%. And what that means is the more imports we have in this country, that reduces GDP. Because when you buy something that's manufactured overseas, the retailer that sold it to you may make a retail profit, but the manufacturers that made it overseas are making that profit. So we're still not going to see these economic numbers the Fed is forecasting. The Fed is forecasting the economy will grow at 2.4% this year. And in order to do that, we're going to have to hit 2.7% economic growth rates in the second, third, and fourth quarter of the year. There's just no way that's going to happen. The numbers, I don't care if you're looking at the ISM, the regional Fed surveys, they just don't add up to those kind of economic numbers. And the other problem that we have here, it's not just the strengthening dollar, but you also have weak economies overseas, and that's being reflected in the trade deficit numbers where Americans are importing more goods from overseas than what we're exporting, and this is an issue that Trump is making in the campaign.
You know, this sort of verifies what you've been hinting at here, that employment numbers are down, temporary employment, as a matter of fact, the numbers are falling in that category as well. So this seems to be a trend that is not going to be changing anytime in the near future.
No, in fact, one of the things that you'll see in the future, and especially when full implementation of Obamacare goes into effect in 2017, is you're going to see more part-time employment. And that's why we were watching that closely with some of these unemployment numbers when we were creating a couple hundred thousand jobs. We were starting to notice beginning in the fourth quarter of last year that temporary employment began to fall. The hours worked each week began to fall. And John, we've seen that in the unemployment numbers. I mean, if you take a look at over the last 12 months, we've been averaging roughly about 220,000 jobs created every month. If you take the first 3 months or the last 3 months of the year, that number has dropped in half to 116,000 jobs a month. And now we just got the May report and there were only 38,000 jobs that were created versus the estimate of 158,000. It's amazing to see what's happened in the Fed funds futures market. There was a low probability for a June rate hike, but the probability that the Fed would go in July was raised to almost 50%. Well, we just got this unemployment number today with 38,000 jobs, pointing to a consistent trend now of weakening employment. John, that number for a July rate hike just got thrown out the window.
Yeah, and the administration, though, is touting how great the unemployment figures have dropped here to, what, 4.7%, that everything's going well. But that's what politicians do, on the other hand.
Yeah, but there was a reason why the unemployment rate dropped to 4.7%. Over a 500,000 people dropped out of the workforce. They stopped looking for jobs. So that drove that number down. The participation rate, that's the number of workers actively looking for jobs or working, dropped to 62.6. So you have the unemployment rate dropping because a lot of people just aren't looking for jobs anymore. So that's not a real accurate figure. What is more concerning, and it's got to be reconcerning to the Fed, is we've got a trend going here with unemployment. It began with part-time workers. That was the first area that got hit. Second area that got hit was the hours worked per week. So if you're an employer, maybe you're not going to layoffs yet, but what you start doing is you let go your part-time workers. The next thing you do is you start cutting your work week, and then the next thing you stop doing is hiring, and the next thing you do is you start laying off workers. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about the coming layoffs in the tech sector, and that is a high-margin business. It's a high-paying business, and that is going to impact the economy. But, John, we've gone in the last 12 months from creating over 200,000 jobs a month to 116, now to 38,000. That's why we've been emphasizing the part-time workers get hit first, the hours worked get hit second. So we have seen a consistent trend with these leading indicators. And that is why it was absolutely amazing. Until we got this number today, the odds for a July rate hike were increasing to almost 50%. Now, that just totally got obliterated today, and the odds just dropped tremendously. And that's why you're seeing a big, big jump in gold today. Gold had a big, big pop on this Friday, up $32, because basically they're saying, hey, with these kind of job numbers, the rate hikes are off the table.
Yeah, and this just echoes what we've said here on the program before, that the odds and the probability of a recession for next year, not during this year, but next year, keep increasing. And what it is it's a subtle trend. And you could say, well, okay, that's just a bump. But if the trend continues over time, you will see this actually build.
Well, it is a trend. And remember, it starts out, it's very nuanced, as we talked about several months ago, as we were seeing the drop in temp employment and also the hours worked. Now we're seeing that confirmed with a more important number, is the number of jobs that are being created. As I said, you know, in the last 3 months, the number of jobs created have dropped in half over what we saw the previous 12 months. And we just got that dismal number today. It's amazing, too, because the probability of a recession is now increased to 34%. Our recession indicator is over 20% in climbing. So, John, what have we seen? We've seen a slowdown in the rate of economic growth that began in the fourth quarter of 2014. The economy, in our opinion, peaked in the summer of 2014. And we've been on a trajectory, on a downward trajectory since the middle of 2014. We also know that profits for U.S. corporations peaked in 2014. So GDP is definitely slowing down, and we are in the final stages. I mean, there's four parts to an economic cycle. You have the early phase recovery, which is, you know, think of us coming out of 2009, probably to 2012. 2012 to 2014 is the mid part of the cycle. And now, in our opinion, we are in the late stage of an economic cycle. And I would suspect either probably the early part of next year or the mid part of next year, we're going to be in a recession. So whoever the new president is going to be, it's just like, you know, lucky for Obama, he's getting out of town come next January, because it was just kind of like Bernanke taking over from Greenspan in 2006. Look what Bernanke inherited. He inherited a financial crisis, a recession, and probably the worst financial crisis that we've seen in this country since the Great Depression. So the next president, whoever he or she may be, is going to be facing a U.S. recession.
If we were to combine the economic numbers with other indicators, what might there be that would confirm this concept that we're in the latter stage of an economic recovery and sliding down into a recession?
Well, what you usually see in the latter part or the latter stages of a business cycle is economic growth begins to moderate. And we saw that, as I mentioned, economic growth peaked in the summer of 2014. And the economic numbers have been dismal since then. Look, last year, it took the Fed an entire year to raise interest rates a quarter of a point because they couldn't get the economic momentum. And what was happening is they withdrew stimulus, that $80 billion that they were pumping into the economy. As that began to withdraw and end, they could not get the economic stimulus that they wanted to raise rates. They always would hold back. Oh, we're going to do it. No, we're not. The on again, off again. And what are we doing this year? We're doing the same thing. Just today, the odds of a probability of a rate hike in July just got chopped in half, obliterated with this unemployment report. So the first thing that you see is economic growth begins to moderate. We're already seeing that. Second thing that you see is credit begins to get tightened, because what do banks do? If they sense the economy is slowing down, they're going to get more circumspect on making their loans. We're already seeing it in the Fed survey of loan officers. They've cut back on commercial industrial loans. Right now, about the only area that's strong credit-wise, believe it or not, is housing. Mortgages, home equity loans are still going pretty good. Third thing that you usually see is corporate earnings begin to come under pressure. And as we said, profits have peaked in the second quarter of 2014. That's when they peaked. They came under pressure with the energy sector. Of course, that had a great impact on S&P earnings, a rising dollar impacting manufacturing. Now, companies are facing squeezed margins. They're unable to increase sales prices as much, and they have rising wages, which are going to weigh on profits. So earnings are under pressure. And then also, what we're also seeing is policy is contractionary. What is the Fed talking about? They keep talking about raising interest rates. They're not talking about lowering interest rates at this point. That usually comes when you're in the middle of a crisis or a recession, because the Fed will always react in delay. So we have contractionary policy. And the other thing that we're looking at, inventories beginning to grow, sales beginning to contract. Companies are having a hard time increasing the top line. And that is, all of these things, John, are indicative of a late stage of an economic recovery. So, you know, once again, we're still holding on to our belief that we're going to see some kind of recession. It might be a mild one, because there really isn't a lot of bubble-like characteristics. Yes, stock prices are expensive. Yes, real estate prices keep going up and making it more expensive. But there isn't a bubble like we saw in tech land in 1999 or in housing in 2006 and 2007. So if we have a recession, it might be a mild one. And I suspect what you're going to see, the new president, whoever that may be, work with Congress, and you will see fiscal spending combined with monetary policy as we head into that next recession.
Well, it's interesting because the Fed seems to keep holding the course. You know, on Friday, Fed Chair Janet Yellen gave a speech saying they were adamant that they were going to raise rates. Now, it seems they're determined to do this. They are going to create this wiggle room and hope that everything adjusts. Now, we're not going to hit the growth rates they've been anticipating. And look at the unemployment rate that came out this Friday. They're going to force this no matter what.
You know, they keep talking about it, and I understand where they want to go with this. I mean, basically, they would like to get some bullets in the chamber, because they know a recession and a crisis down the road is coming, and they want to have some bullets to fire if they get into that crisis. I mean, when we got into the crisis in 2007, the Fed funds rate was at 5%. They brought it down to almost zero. The problem is, John, when they start talking about this, there are consequences. And if we take a look at the Fed feedback loop, the Fed starts talking about raising interest rates. What happens? The dollar begins to appreciate. Credit spreads begin to widen. The VIX index becomes more volatile. Volatility rises in the market. Stock prices fall and the yield curve flattens. So we've already seen a little bit of uptick in the dollar. We're already seeing credit spreads begin to widen. The VIX has been somewhat subtle because stocks have been going up. Now, when they begin to ease, which is what we see when, like, for example, in January, when the Fed came out with the dovish statement following the FOMC meeting, and then in March, when they revised lower their rate hikes from 4 to 2 for the year, and they got very dovish, you see the opposite effect. And look what happened after that March meeting. The dollar depreciates, credit spreads begin to tighten, meaning the spread between junk bonds and sovereign bonds. The volatility index drops in the market as stocks go up, stocks rise, and the yield curve steepens. And right now, John, we're sort of on a teeter-totter. We're right in the middle. We're balanced between tightening conditions and loosening conditions. We're right there right now. Because once again, until this Friday, until this unemployment report, the market was pricing in, as of yesterday, they were going to go in May, given what Yellen said last Friday, given what the Fed governors have said. And here we get this economic bombshell on Friday with only 38,000 jobs. So once again, we are seeing this thing take place. We've got the bad effects of regulation, the bad effects of taxes. All of that is starting to weigh on the economy, and the Fed is in that policy tightening mode, even though they've only tightened once. Remember, just by their very words, the market reacts to that, as it did last fall, as it did recently with Yellen and Fed governors as of last Friday talking about possibly going in July. I think the unemployment report that we just got took the July rate hike off the table, which means, John, we're repeating last year. Remember, we were going to go in June. When we began 2015, it was a June rate hike. Then it didn't happen in June. It was a September rate hike. It didn't happen September. Didn't happen October. They finally went in December saying, hey, we're very confident we're going to raise rates 4 times. The economy's going to grow, the unemployment rate. And look, they reversed it in January and March. And we're repeating the same cycle that we repeated last year. And there's another cycle that gets repeated when the Fed tightens by either its words, its speeches. When the dollar appreciates, stocks fall. It also changes what happens in the market. Luis Yamada and I talked about these rapid rotations we're seeing. And we're seeing something right now in terms of the stock to bond ratio, in terms of which is returning a better return to investors. And we went from that low in February, where you were doing well as a bond investor, to where we are recently, where you're doing better as a stock investor. So the minute the Fed begins to tighten, that stock to bond ratio begins to reverse itself and bonds begin to do better than stocks.
If we wrap all this together, what does this actually mean for investors and actions that should be taken?
Well, I mean, the RORO trade, which is the risk on, the risk off. We've been in the risk on trade. I think the risk on trade may be coming to an end. We don't know yet. I mean, it's going to depend once again what the Fed begins to say after this dismal unemployment report. I mean, if we're seeing these trends, these guys have got to see these trends. So watch how that language may change. But we're starting to see credit spreads widen. So if you're in high yield bonds or junk bonds, you may want to consider taking profits, because if credit spreads widen, you're going to begin to lose money. And also, John, we're in a very, very, despite all this, we're, as Luis Yamada said in hour one, we're really in a trading market. I mean, this thing changes so rapidly. It almost changes every 3 months, where it's risk on. Then all of a sudden we get bad economic numbers, or the Fed starts talking tough, and it's the risk off trade. And I think we're going to be closer to the risk off trade. And besides that, stocks aren't really cheap. And it's one of the reasons, you know, there's been a number of studies. McKinsey came out, said expect low returns over the next decade, given where price earnings multiples are today and given what's happening to profits. I mean, this trade of, you know, companies issuing debt, buying back stock, raising dividends, that's slowing down. We're seeing dividend increases slow down. So I still like dividends. I mean, if you're only going to get low single digit returns in the market, I'd rather get most of that from dividends, where it's assured, than bet on the price of the stock going up. We like short-term bonds. I think that's a good place to be. And I also like gold. I think we're in a negative interest rate environment. And on this Friday, what happened? In terms of this unemployment report, the expectations for a rate increase dropped. And what happened? Gold responded. Gold was up $32. And why? Because they're saying, well, they're not going to raise interest rates, which makes gold more favorable. The other thing I really don't like here when it comes to bonds, I really don't like what I'm seeing in munis. Munis are yielding less than sovereigns. They've been bid up tremendously because of the high taxes. In the talk coming from Sanders and Hillary Clinton about raising taxes, I mean, tax rates will go over 50% for a lot of Americans. So munis have been a spectacular performer in the bond market, but I just don't like the yields here.
Well, there's always that perennial prediction of a stock market crash. Any possibility here mixed up in this?
You know, I really don't see it. I mean, when I say I really don't see it, I mean, there always can be that unexpected rogue wave that shows up out of nowhere that nobody expects. And one of the things about a weakening economy, an economy can absorb shocks to itself, where the stock market, when the economy is growing, it becomes less of a shock absorber as the economy slows down. But I think low interest rates are going to keep a cap in terms of what happens in the stock market. And that's certainly what we've seen since November of 2014. We've seen these corrections along the way. We've been sort of going sideways for almost a year and a half. And as some of the technicians on the program have talked about, we're probably more into a time correction than anything else. But I think once we head into a recession, most crashes in stock market history, with the exception of, let's say, 1987, have been associated with a recession. So the more and closer we come to a recession, the more vulnerable the stock market will become.
Okay, well, if we've taken an analogy from nautical ideas, the barometer seems to be dropping. That's usually indicative of a storm. Even New England fishermen used to recognize that with their New England fishermen's glasses. Somewhere out there, there's a storm. And so I would guess, what? We're going to play this defensively.
I would be playing defensive. We saw a nice run-up in high-yield bonds as the thought of a Fed rate cycle or rate raising was postponed at the beginning of the year. We've had a nice run-up in high yields. We've had a nice run-up in stocks. Could we get a summer rally like last year? Sure. Especially if all of a sudden, based on this unemployment report that we got on Friday and this weakening trend in employment, all of a sudden you start seeing Fed governors over the next 6 weeks start talking very dovish, then I think that might give us a little bit more play. But I just think the stock market is having a tough time pushing through these resistance levels. And the reason is what's happening within corporations themselves. Corporate profits have peaked. Companies are having a hard time increasing sales, increasing prices, and margins are being squeezed. I just think it's going to be a tough time for the market breaking through those upper barriers. I could be wrong. Maybe the Fed can reverse course, but I would just play it cautious. I mean, I'm just following the trends that we're seeing in the economy right now, and we keep getting confirmation of these weakening trends with this unemployment report he got on this Friday. So if I was an investor, I would stay cautious and play it safe.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is George Gilder, well-known speaker, prolific author, and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, to discuss his latest book, The Scandal of Money, Why Wall Street Recovers, But the Economy Never Does. George, when you think about money today, do you see it more as a measuring stick or a magic wand?
That's a good question. My theme is that money is a measuring stick. It has to accurately gauge economic conditions all around the world. And if it changes from place to place and from time to time, it's like changing the hour or the foot or the meter or the second or any of these other measuring sticks that are crucial to having components in manufacturing and then be fungible in factories around the world. Money is a measuring stick, and what worries me is governments are increasingly using it as a magic wand to summon growth, and that is a mistake, and it's the scandal of money that I describe in my book.
So the title of your book is, once again, The Scandal of Money. And so in your mind, the scandal that's being perpetuated is this changing of the measuring stick. And like you said, if we were just to take a ruler, as you see it, central banks are adjusting the length of that as they see fit. Is that the scandal that's taking place?
That is a crucial part of the scandal. It's taking what should be a measuring stick and making it into an elastic device that's used to manipulate the economy by fooling people. I mean, if the measuring stick is completely reliable and can be translated readily from one index to another, then changing it wouldn't have any effect on people's behavior. But today, we're constantly changing the measuring stick in order to induce people to spend when they otherwise wouldn't spend or to invest when they're disinclined to invest. And the result is that money no longer guides the economy. It no longer provides reliable information to entrepreneurs. It no longer has a yield for saving. Zero interest rates signify zero opportunity cost to spending now. So it's really lying about the economy. It's kind of Pravda money. The government believes that the consumer is 70% of the economy, and it wants to induce the consumer to spend as if spending itself created value rather than the advance of learning and knowledge and research and initiative and risk-taking, all the entrepreneurial creativity that really constitutes the source of all wealth and growth.
Everybody would like to know the future. Imagine if you knew what the winning lottery ticket number was going to be, what you could do with that. Ironically, it's not quite the same thing in the markets, but a lot of people like to know what's happening. So projections are always a big thing. Remember back at the beginning of the year, we even had projections that oil might get down to $10 a barrel, but we bounced at 20. Now we're back to 50. So it's amazing how quickly markets can turn around and disappoint some of the projections and the hopes and fears of many of the investors.
You know, as Kurt Wolf and I talked about in hour one, John, it just seems like the oil market goes from boom to bust. I mean, we were down to $26 in February and projections down to 10. Here we are on this Friday, we're closer to 50. And when you think about it, towards the end of 2014, we were at $110 a barrel. And we had been in the low 90s and 100. And of course, we had that peak of 150 in the summer of 2008. But, you know, here we are from the high that we reached in 2014. The price of oil fell 77%. And as Kurt and I talked about, this has had a devastating impact on a lot of the energy industry. Over 300,000 jobs have been lost. A lot of CapEx expenditures, literally hundreds of billions of dollars have been cut. Hundreds of thousands of workers have lost their jobs. And part of this is technological innovation. And the greatest impact, as we've talked so many times on the show, has been the impact of American shale, which brought on 4 million barrels of additional oil production. And as a result of that, OPEC made the decision, unlike the past where they would cut oil production, they're saying it won't do us any good. If we cut oil, we're just going to lose market share. The Americans will just pump more oil and somebody else will get the business. So they pumped all out. OPEC is at record levels in production, including Saudi Arabia, including Russia, and the major producers in OPEC. And the result was we got a glut in oil to the extent of almost 2 million barrels a day. And of course, inventories had to build up. They were putting them in major storage centers like at Cushing and elsewhere around the globe. They were putting them on ships. So we had all of this supply in storage, and the story really became overproduction. Then the overproduction and glut was then tied in on the demand side with weaker economic growth. Now, never mind the fact that oil consumption has been going up every single year, even despite the fact that the Chinese economy has slowed down tremendously. And of course, the Chinese have had the greatest impact on oil itself in terms of consumption, now having the second largest economy in the world. But the fact remains is that we will consume globally more oil this year than last year. But when you have this scenario, overproduction, increasing supply, storage bins filled to the top, then anything that happens economically just sort of weaves into that scenario. So weak economic growth was tied into that scenario. And you had, as Louise and I talked about in hour one, you had this coupling with stock prices and oil prices. They would move in tandem. Oil prices go up, stock prices would go up because they figure, oh, that's good for the economy. Oil prices would go down, stock prices would go down. That's pretty much the way it's played in the last 12 months. Now, as Louise was talking about, that's normally not a natural correlation with the stock market. But nonetheless, we had this scenario of an oversupply, a glut in production, weakening economic growth. That was the story for probably the last 18 months. John, flip a switch, and now the fear is back in the oil markets.
Okay, what's driving this?
One simple act of nature. We had a fire in the Canadian oil sands that took 1 million barrels off the market. Right now, because of supply outages, whether it's an act of nature, whether it's a terrorist attack, whether it's declining production because shale makers are cutting the rig count, 3.5 million barrels are offline right now because of disruptions. Right now, you have a new terrorist group in Nigeria that are attacking oil supply centers. You had the wildfires in Canada. I mean, who would have figured that one? I mean, yeah, you can think about oil or terrorist attacks in the Middle East. I mean, just turn on your nightly TV, and there's always some kind of bombing or something going on in the Middle East. It's almost something we live with. And now we also have political unrest in Libya. So as we currently stand, 3.5 million barrels have been taken offline. And as Kurt and I talked about in hour one, that cushion of extra supply is really not there or as large as it used to be. We used to have within OPEC and the global oil producing community, we had 5 to 10 million barrels of spare oil producing capacity. Well, as Kurt and I talked about, a lot of that capacity is being taken offline with Western oil companies as they throttle back on drilling and exploration. They're not replacing their reserves. That tells us we're going to have problems down the road. But I would say, John, political unrest, as we're seeing in the Middle East today, is probably one of the biggest threats. And in South America, where it looks like Venezuela may undergo a revolution with the failure of Chavez's socialism, which is basically bankrupting the country, hyperinflation, shortages, starvation, all kinds of things. If anybody thinks that socialism is a great thing, just watch what's going on in Venezuela right now. But it's a very, very fragile market. It just goes to show you how one little fire in the Canadian oil sands and wham, overnight, 1 million barrels was taken offline.
But Jim, let's do some devil's advocacy here. Remember back in 2011, there was the Arab Spring, and of course that unleashed much of what we are seeing in the Middle East today. There have been these type of interruptions in the past, and sometimes oil would spike up as a result of that, but it would settle down. So why are things different this time?
Well, and let's go back to 2011. American shale production was just ramping up with shale production and horizontal drilling and fracking. So American production wasn't where it was in, let's say, 2015, when we got up to 9.6 million barrels. I think we were around 7 million barrels back in 2011. So when Libyan oil production was taken offline, that was 1.6 million barrels. And you saw the price of oil spike up to over $110. It was 120 something on Brent crude. Now, since 2012, you've had disruptions that repeatedly, on and off, have kept 2 million barrels of production offline. But the big change, John, was American oil production ramped up by almost 4 million barrels a day to 9.6 million barrels, which is where we peaked in the U.S. in the summer of last year. So it's a different story right now. And even though we've seen oil prices here spike from $26, I mean, if you think about getting down to 26, down to 50, we've almost seen the price of oil double here in 3 months. But a lot of the big oil companies are really sitting online. You know, Shell just this week announced they're laying off an additional 5,000 workers. Chevron just announced they're cutting their exploration and CapEx budget by 10%. So it's a very capital intensive business. And just because you get a spike in oil prices over a three-month period, especially when they happen real fast, as they just did. I mean, when you go to 26 to 50 in 3 months, that's pretty fast. And oil executives are saying, look, this happened real fast. It spiked. We're not sure this will stay there. And especially when we're seeing weakening economic signs, both in the U.S. and globally, and especially in China. So what we're more likely to see is a new trading range for oil between, let's say, $40 and $50 a barrel. I know Kurt was talking about his target is $70. We may see that if we have some more supply disruptions, but we're more likely to trade in this $40 to $50 range, which means we could see a little bit more shale production come online. But the trend is for the big companies, John, they're not replacing the reserves. They're not about to go out and spend a lot of money, because for the big guys, most of the stuff they do is offshore, and you need $70 and $80 oil for that to become profitable. You can't produce oil offshore profitably at $50 or less.
Well, there are also reports, Jim, such as the IEA and others. What are they saying?
Mainly non-OPEC production will be down by another 500,000 barrels this year. That's mainly going to come from the United States. So non-OPEC production will drop down to roughly about 8.1 million barrels a day. U.S. production this year will be down close to 10%. As I said, by the end of the year, we will be down by a full million barrels a day. And that's why you've seen this sudden change in perception now, because the oil traders in the markets know, yes, we got a lot of oil sitting in inventory on tankers right now. That's going to be working its way down in the second half of the year, because we have roughly about 3.5 million barrels that are offline in terms of production right now. And the markets, and this is once again a change in perception, as we go back to what we talked about at the beginning here. At the beginning of the year, the scenario was rising production, slowing demand, increase in inventory. That whole scenario is now flip-flopped, and especially the Canadian oil sands just shows how vulnerable the oil markets can be. And contrary to statements being made in Washington, the Middle East is becoming more volatile and more subject to disruptions in oil supply. It's not just Nigeria. It's not just Iraq. It's not just Libya. Now it's possibly even Venezuela, where they may have a revolution there. I know the government is trying to stop it with the police and trying to get the military to protect the government. But the people are, I mean, just, you know, the press has covered some of it. They're rioting. They're starving. They're going into garbage cans to get food. And this is just a very volatile situation, not only in South America, but we're also seeing it, especially in the Middle East, as the U.S. has withdrawn, and the whole place has just become a giant quagmire. I remember a number of years ago, I did an interview. I can't think of his name offhand, but he wrote a book on the Middle East. And he said the Middle East is one giant gas station with madmen going around lighting matches. And that's what we're starting to see. So one of the things that the markets are now starting to perceive, and that's why the fear trade is back now. And you'll see anytime there's a major terrorist attack or there's a major terrorist attack on an oil facility, you'll see a spike in oil prices, and why we're trading close to $50 a barrel than we are, let's say, $20 a barrel.
I'm not sure how many people actually realize, Jim, that 65% of the world's oil reserves are located in the most volatile region of the oil. Were they not, then it might not quite be the same dynamic playing out.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a number of black swan events that seem to be occurring. And there was a major study that was just published by a oil monitoring service. and they talked about major, major political risk in Venezuela, Nigeria, Iraq, and Libya. It could be very disruptive, and these are some of the biggest risks for 2016. In Venezuela, you may say a coup d'etat against Maduro's government. And Venezuela is estimated to be producing between 2 and 2.3 million barrels a day. There's a possible Povesta strike that could happen as 40% of its workforce was summarily fired by Chavez and also Maduro. So there is a risk to Venezuelan oil supply. If you want to take a look at Nigeria, the country is divided in two parts. You have the Christian South and the Muslim North, and they're both at war with each other, with various groups attacking oil facilities. Because what you're doing when you're at war is you're trying to disrupt the economy of your opponent. And one of the ways to do that is to disrupt the oil markets. And so that's taking place in Nigeria. So you have a lot of oil facilities. A Shell facility just got attacked that was producing 250,000 barrels a day. In Iraq, you've got ISIS in there. They're targeting oil facilities because that's where the Iraqi government gets the bulk of its oil revenues to take care of government. You've got other places like Libya, where there's a civil war going on within the country and various factions. So this is something that, you know, there's always been three aspects to oil. And one of them has been geopolitics. And those are the hardest things to sort of estimate. How can you predict when the next terrorist attack is going to take place? Where is it going to be? What are they going to attack? I mean, just take a look at terrorist attacks. Generally, they come out of nowhere at you when you least suspect them, in places you don't suspect them. And one of the top priorities for the terrorists right now are oil facilities. The terrorists want to gain control over oil because that's revenue. That's what's going to support their armies. It's going to support their wealth. It's going to support their government. And that's why oil itself is under attack in the Middle East by various factions. So the greatest risk that we have here is political risk going into this market. And that is why all of a sudden, I would say the Canadian oil sands was probably the last straw that changed perceptions in the market. And what we're seeing right now, John, for the first time, is the fear trade come back into the oil markets. And it was interesting, just as they were predicting $10 oil earlier in the year, they are now predicting $50, $60, and $70 oil. So even the oil traders and the oil analysts are now starting to up their projections in terms of where they see the price of oil. I see it in the $40 range to $50 range, maybe mid-40s to mid-50s as a trading range.
But you would think, Jim, if we got a disruption, there would be higher prices, right?
Well, typically you would, but one of the things that's happening in the oil markets, and this is especially happening in the futures market, if you're an oil companies are hedging their future production. So if you're an oil company producing oil in 2016, you are selling oil for production delivery into 2017 and 2018. I mean, think of it. If you're an oil company and you just saw the price of oil in February drop to $26 a barrel, and 3 months later, you're seeing $50 a barrel, what are you doing? You are locking in higher prices. For example, in the futures market right now, you can get anywhere from $52 to $58 a barrel for future delivery. So that long-term hedging by these oil companies and the commercials is going to keep a lid on the upward price of oil. That's not to say that something really, really major like what we saw happen in the Canadian oil sands could drive those prices higher. But right now, because of hedging by oil companies and futures traders, that's going to keep an upward limit. So I think that what you're going to see is this trading range between the mid-40s and the mid-50s, which is going to be good for the most efficient shale producers. But I'm just looking at the spare capacity gap, which was huge, has narrowed considerably here since the beginning of the year as a result of a lot of Western oil companies pulling back on their rig count, cutting back on production. As I mentioned, the IEA estimates that U.S. production will drop by another 500,000 barrels a day this year. So we will be down by 1 million barrels from our peak production in last year. And also, this could lead to a very different situation in the oil market where you have backwardation, meaning that refiners are going to be bidding for crude from storage as markets go deeper into deficit. And what that's going to do, it's going to force the front end of the spot curve to trade higher, meaning that, let's say, current spot contracts for oil will sell at higher prices than future prices. So we could see this oil market go into backwardation as a result of this contraction in supply. So if you're an oil investor and you were smart enough to buy some oil stocks when prices were down, well, number one, you got a great dividend. And of course, we see oil stocks, and I agree with Louise and Kurt, that oil stocks, especially in the late stage of a business cycle, in the precarious nature of the Middle East right now with oil supplies, oil is going to be a good trade, I think, for 2016, John. We've seen it already, and we're more likely to see it in the future.
Well, as we were talking about during the show here today, June, July, the question is, will the Fed raise rates? And given dismal numbers, are they going to plow ahead with it? Well, that remains to be seen. It's interesting how we have this speculation all the time. Anything else we should be watching in the weeks that are coming?
Towards the end of this month, we will be getting some warnings on second quarter Q2. We will be done with the first half of the year. Kind of hard to believe that we're already in December, John, and the second quarter will be ending here in the next couple of weeks. So if you're a company and you're going to have some bad numbers, you're going to want to get the dirty laundry out before the quarter ends on June 30th. So we'll be looking at earnings numbers. I really think this jobs number is thrown a lot of water onto fires of a rate hike coming in July. It's amazing how one number like that can change. But as we pointed out in the big picture, this has been a continuous trend. So they've got to be rethinking. And then I just, you know, John, as we get to September, close to an election, do you really think the Fed's going to want to be raising rates? I just think this is almost going to go down like last year. We may end up with only one rate hike, and it may only come in December, and God knows what the economic numbers are going to look like. I also think that another issue that's going to start to become more important for the markets will be the political election for 2016. We've got the political conventions coming up in the summer, and as the Democratic platform will be put forth, investors will know exactly what will happen if Hillary is president, what she's going to do. We know she's going to increase spending and raise taxes to over 50%. That isn't good. That's assuming that she doesn't get indicted. Then we also have the Republican convention, which will have a platform as well. And as we get closer to the election, you'll see markets pay more and more attention, just as, for example, in 2008, when it looked like Barack Obama was going to become a president, everybody was looking at what he said he was going to do, just like 2012. So I think, John, this is going to be one of those years, geopolitics when it comes to oil and politics when it comes to the stock market with the presidential election. So I think a lot of that will become the focus of the markets in the months ahead. And of course, we'll be here watching those economic numbers, folks. We've got a trend developing, as we've been talking about here in the program, on the employment front, and that's usually the canary in the coal mine signaling what may lie ahead, possibly at the end of the year or sometime next year, the possibility of another U.S. recession. In the meantime, well, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.